So welcome to today's interview. I'm talking with Dr. David Brady. David Brady is a foremost authority on properly diagnosing and treating fibromyalgia. He's published in leading peer-reviewed medical journals, including the Open Journal of Rheumatology and Autoimmune Disease and Integrative Medicine. He is in private practice at Whole Body Medicine in Fairfield, and additionally is the Director of Human Nutrition Institute at the University of Bridgeport, as well as the Chief Medical Officer of Designs for Health Incorporated and of Diagnostic Solutions Laboratory LLC. Dr. David Brady, thank you very much for your time for joining me today.
Oh, my pleasure. It's always a great opportunity to be on and share some information on these disorders that are so elusive to so many, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Brilliant. Thank you. Well, we're going to get, I think, quite deep into fibromyalgia, particularly some of the differences between fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue. As I've been diving deeper into your work, one of the things I most appreciate is that you make a very clear differentiation, and indeed a lot of things that get lumped in with being fibromyalgia help create some separation and some clarity for people with that. So we'll come into that in a bit. But I think a good starting point would be, what got you so interested in fibromyalgia in the first place? What was the thing that drew you in?
Oh, that's an interesting question. And there is, as always, there's a story, right? You know, my initial training was as an engineer, right? And then I decided to go into healthcare. And I was really, I thought I'd be interested more in biomechanical research and biomedical engineering. And so before I ever went to medical school or even studied nutrition and botanical medicine and so forth, I went to chiropractic school. And I went to chiropractic college here because it's really one of the best educations in functional biomechanics and how they help the human condition from a physical medicine perspective. And when I went through that training, I actually took a left turn because many of my mentors in the program I happened to choose, unbeknownst to me, were really into interventional nutrition, into what we would call naturopathic medicine more now, you know, in the modern sense, botanical medicine, and many different ways to deal with chronic complex metabolic disorders without or in a complementary way to pharmaceuticals. So including, you know, lifestyle intervention and diet and so forth. So I was immersed in this new world. And I combined that with a kind of an inclination to be interested in that because when I was growing up in the 70s, my mother battled breast cancer almost my whole childhood. And I literally saw her get chemotherapy, radiation, like old school, like when it was even more brutal than it is right now. And some of the best outcomes she got toward the end of her life, unfortunately, I wish we had found this sooner, is through some integrative complementary type of physicians who really improved their quality of life at the end. So it made a big impression on me. And, you know, I went to chiropractic school and I got out and I started seeing a lot of these really complex patients that had, you know, came in with this label of fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue syndrome or combinations thereof. And I realized very, very quickly, honestly, that I was totally incapable of helping them. I did not have the right training. I didn't know enough. What I learned about these disorders, turns out looking backward now, was what I learned about it was wrong. Most of what they taught me was absolutely wrong. And most of it was taught from the perspective of, you know, questioning whether it really exists, condescension, you know, and all of that. And, but I realized once I started seeing these patients that they had some significant issues that were bigger than what we were taught fibromyalgia is. Like if you ask most doctors, even today, or most healthcare providers, what is fibromyalgia, they'll tell you a lot of things that are patently incorrect. Like it's a muscle problem. It's not a muscle problem. It's a brain problem, right? That it's inflammatory. It's not systematically inflammatory. They'll say it's an autoimmune disease. It's not autoimmune. And, you know, they'll give you a lot of other, you know, ideas about it, that it's chronic fatigue syndrome, right? And it's not exactly the same as chronic fatigue syndrome. So I figured out very quickly, I didn't know enough about it. I basically went to the medical literature, which is more challenging at the time than it is now. You know, now you just go on the internet
You had to go to a library and you have to find books.
Yeah, I had to go to the Jesse Jones Medical Library in Houston and dig through the card catalogs and blow dust off journals and put quarters in Xerox machines. And I basically read everything.
It takes a month to get the journal shipped in, right? The one they haven't got that you need.
Exactly. And then I reached out personally to many of the world's experts in fibromyalgia to get even more information and to kind of talk to them. And over the course of about a decade and a half, me and a colleague of mine who had the same kind of thing going on, Michael Schneider, who's now a researcher at the University of Pittsburgh, we made ourselves fibromyalgia experts. And then later on, we both went into academia in addition to clinical practice. So we both ended up doing research in the field and doing a lot of publishing in fibromyalgia, writing textbooks and so forth. So, you know, here we are almost 30 years later. It's the end, you know, way far down this journey. But what got me involved in it was sheer desperation that I didn't know how to help these people. And I knew they weren't making it up. They had significant problems. And I also knew another thing. I knew from my limited understanding at the time that they weren't all the same. They didn't all have the same thing. But a lot of different things were all getting called fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue syndrome. It was this sort of lazy basket diagnosis. And you know, one of the first days of medical school, you learn that proper diagnosis is half the cure. If you don't know what you're dealing with, how do you really propose to find a viable interventional strategy to really help someone in an efficient, efficacious way? So a lot of my initial publications in the field of fibromyalgia, global pain and fatigue, was really to my colleagues to try to get them up to speed and try to get them to understand that you really have to pay attention and properly differentially diagnose these patients and not just assume they have fibromyalgia because they've been labeled with it. Because if you don't get the diagnosis right, you're probably not going to get the treatment right.
Yes. One of the things that before we come more into that, one of the things that I'm also curious about is that for many physicians, seeing this group of illnesses is often, it's overwhelming. People want to, of course, have clarity and have answers, and often those are not at least forthcoming in the ways that one would be used to. What do you think it was about your makeup or you as a practitioner that you became curious and you wanted to dive deeper where others, in a sense, are kind of, to put it in a polite way, often not that particularly helpful, let's say, with that group? Why do you think you were so curious to dive deeper and understand?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not sure I ever really thought about it from that perspective, but probably because of my engineering background, I'm curious. I want to know why, right? And I want to try to solve things and try to figure out, you know, what's going on in complex systems and how you can bring it back to balance. And so I guess I saw it a bit as a challenge. I would like to think, you know, the reason I became a doctor is because I'm compassionate and I like to try to help people. Sure. Who need help. And I wasn't willing to give up. And probably because I was naive enough early in my career that I still held really strongly to those principles where, you know, some of the older physicians I feel can be very dismissive of these things like fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, and so forth, that they were trained never to really even deal with them and to question them and think that it was all sort of made up. And you know, doctors have big egos, and quite frankly, when they feel like they don't have a lot to offer someone or they don't know the answer, it threatens their world, right? And they get a little defensive and they act pretty stupidly sometimes. And you end up with patients who are dismissed, feeling like they're not understood, not being listened to, and frankly, in the end, they're underserved and they don't get the kind of care they deserve. So I think that was a motivating factor to me, to a large degree.
Yes. And it takes a certain, I think, level of courage to be vulnerable with one's patients and to be vulnerable in that curiosity and that uncertainty and not knowing. And I look at some of the things that we were doing at Optimum Health Clinic 15, 16 years ago when we started, and I slightly cringe in memory that it, but yeah, we were trying to figure out and we were trying to learn. And it takes a courage and a vulnerability to be willing to learn. And clearly that's hugely served this group of conditions that you've taken that approach.
I've never had a particular problem with telling people I don't know, but I'm going to try to find out. Right. I'm going to try to find the answer. I've actually gone into patient treatment rooms when I've already known the patient for a while, right? I've been working with them for a length of time, and I'll walk in and say, "Hi, Mrs. Jones, I'm Dr. Smith." And they'll say, "Well, you're not Dr. Smith, you're Dr. Brady. What are you talking about? You're Dr. Smith." And I say, "No, today I'm Dr. Smith because Dr. Brady clearly has no idea what's wrong with me." We're starting again, you know?
That's great.
We're starting it all over because clearly I missed something, you know?
That's great. And I can just imagine how much patients appreciate that
willingness. They laugh. Totally.
Because they're used to going to places no one's got the answers, and someone that's willing to hang in there and find the path forwards, of course, is crucial. So coming on to, you kind of alluded to this, but how would you define fibromyalgia? So specifically fibromyalgia, how would you classify and define that?
Well, it's interesting. Fibromyalgia really, in its classic sense, and I'll use that word classic fibromyalgia, meaning that it has all the classical characteristics of what the literature is talking about, what the research is really pointing to when they're discussing this disorder, that it, at its root, is really a central sensitivity, or what we call a hypervigilance disorder. It really involves central pain processing, central sensory input processing that is doing some things that are not optimal or normal. And so it has all the classic characteristics. And we use that terminology because in my experience as a clinician, and then talking to a lot of colleagues that also do similar things to what I do, but also in looking at actual research that's been done, the vast majority of people that come in to a provider's office and say they have fibromyalgia or have been diagnosed with fibromyalgia, and that takes many forms, right? It could be that their neighbor told them they have fibromyalgia. It could be that they consulted Dr. Google or WebMD. It could be that their family physician diagnosed them, or it could be that a rheumatologist at an academic center of excellence diagnosed them. But still, the vast majority of them don't have classic fibromyalgia. They have stuff wrong with them, right? They have real problems that they're not making up, but they have issues that the doctor is not getting to the bottom of. It's flying under their radar, so to speak. And they're getting an erroneous labeling of fibromyalgia. And often, unfortunately, they're being put on the medications for fibromyalgia that, if you really don't have a central pain processing disorder or a central sensitivity disorder, the drugs have very little chance of helping you, but a pretty high probability of causing significant side effects. So, you know, it's really critical that you get it right for a lot of reasons. But the classic fibromyalgia patient, they have pretty defined things, right? Their major complaint, if you will, or symptom, if you ask them, is generally this sort of unrelenting achiness or pain in their body. But it's not just anywhere in their body. It's not in specific places. It's not confined to specific regions. This is truly generalized or global pain. They have pain everywhere. They're achy most places in the body, particularly in the softer compliant tissues. And that's where the disorder gets its name. Fibromyalgia. Alga pain, myo muscle, fibro, the fibrous compliant soft tissues. In other words, it's not bone pain. It's not joint pain, right? It's not arthritis. It's pain that's perceived in the softer compliant tissues. But when you dig deep into it, the pain isn't being generated by problems in those tissues. The problem's not in the muscles, it's not in the fascia, it's not in the tendons, it's not in the ligaments. It's in the way they're perceiving their experience in their brain, but they're feeling this pain or perceiving this pain out in these areas of the body. It's not unlike phantom limb pain in someone who's an amputee. Right? Years later, they can still have pain in a leg that's no longer there. Well, I got news for you. The problem is not in the leg. The problem is in the brain and how it's being processed. So treatment directed at the leg obviously isn't going to work. And just the same in classic fibromyalgia, generally, treatment's directed at the somatic tissues, the muscles, the fascia, all the, you know, body work, acupuncture, chiropractic, all of that kind of stuff generally yields poor results unless they also have myofascial pain syndrome or some other type of muscle problem. But it's a central problem that needs to be treated centrally. And since it is a centrally mediated issue, you have other issues that are involved. So it's not only this perception of pain throughout the body, it's centrally mediated phenomena like anxiety, panic attack, common, inability to get into deep, refreshing sleep. So they don't want to get into stage 3 and 4 delta wave restorative rejuvenating sleep. They can sleep 14 hours and they wake up feeling like they never slept. So they can't, they try to sleep their way out of it and they can't, right? So they get up feeling like they never slept. It's called unrefreshed sleep. And it has a very typical pattern in a sleep study that most sleep study centers never look for. It's called alpha wave intrusion during delta wave sleep. But the other manifestations that are centrally mediated, sort of by proxy into the enteric nervous system, is, you know, a lot of vague GI problems, you know, gas, bloating, postprandial distension and bloating, constipation and or constipation alternating with diarrhea. Most of these patients meet the criteria for irritable bowel syndrome and often get diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome. It's almost 100% with true classic fibromyalgia. And then the final latch is persistent unrelenting fatigue. That is different than chronic fatigue syndrome in many ways, particularly in its origins. It's not necessarily that fatigue that tends to come on after a viral, like flu-like illness. There's not objective alterations in the patient's immune system, you know, in the way their lymphocytes are behaving and in the relative counts of their lymphocytes and ratios and so forth. So it's not a post-immune challenge type of fatigue disorder. It's really something different. There just happens to be fatigue associated with this disorder as well. I guess the final thing that's very common in these classic fibromyalgia patients that can help you differentiate it from those who get the label and don't have it is that it's almost always a woman. It's a female disorder. Almost 100%, not 100%, nothing's 100%. But if I have a male in my office saying they have fibromyalgia or being diagnosed with fibromyalgia, I'm very, very skeptical of that diagnosis. It's basically a female disorder, and it's often a learned experience on how that female brain deals with the world and deals with sensory input from a world that the perception of that world was altered usually early in life, usually in early childhood. There's a strong correlation with difficult childhoods, parental strife, divorces, substance abusing parents, physical abuse, verbal abuse, sexual abuse. Not 100%, but it's way more common in these patients that go on to develop fibro, anxiety, panic disorder, IBS than in the general population. So the female brain, when it's young, when it's neuroplastic, when it's learning how to deal with its world, can often get locked into this aberrant stress physiology and get in a state of hypervigilance, which is oddly enough, makes sense, is very similar to what you see in post-traumatic stress disorder physiology, for instance. So Moll and others have researched this and talked about it as life-distressing events, if you will, but they often have difficult stories in their childhood. Yes. It wasn't the greatest thing.
So you're making, I think, some really crucial distinctions here. So I'm going to break some of this down and come through it a bit more. So firstly, you're saying, which I really appreciate, as I mentioned at the start, this distinction between, it's almost like if you're tired and it's unexplained, you get a chronic fatigue diagnosis. Yeah. If you're tired and you have pain, and both are unexplained, you get a fibromyalgia diagnosis.
Particularly if you're a middle-aged woman.
Right. Right.
Absolutely. Yep.
And what you're saying, and I appreciate particularly going deeper into your book as well, is that actually what a lot of people are either self-diagnosing or they're being diagnosed by, you know, physicians that don't have anything like the experience that you have, is there's no investigation for the other origins, be that we can come more to this, be that structural origins, be that functional origins, that could actually be an explanation of those symptoms that when appropriately addressed and treated will actually then result in a resolution. You got it.
It's amazing to me how many patients come in being told they have fibromyalgia by a physician. And this could be a family physician, it could be an internist, it could be a rheumatologist, could be an endocrine, whatever. They come in, they get a diagnosis of fibromyalgia, like you said, because they complain that they have pain, they complain that they're tired a lot, especially if they have some gut problems, right? They get diagnosed with fibromyalgia. They get put on one of the two in the U.S. FDA-approved drugs for fibromyalgia, and we can discuss them and their pros and their cons if you'd like. But they get put on these drugs, which have significant side effect profiles. They're not easy drugs to take. And they've never had blood work done. They've never had their thyroid looked at comprehensively, let alone going into more functional things like mitochondrial ATP energy production, right? Their production of ATP at the mitochondrial level in muscle can be a big issue on why they have pain and why they're fatigued. Thyroid disorders, another big mimicker of fibromyalgia. And then, as you properly alluded to, you know, true somatic structural stuff, things that are more like myofascial pain syndrome and trigger points, which trigger points are not associated with fibromyalgia. They used to be in the original criteria called tender points, but they were distinct from trigger points. And doctors would always confuse those. They'd talk about, I've picked up medical textbooks that are talking about the trigger points of fibromyalgia. They have no clue. This is in a medical textbook. It's just astounding, but it's there.
Yeah, yeah. And so to clarify, what you're really saying is that if you have an explanation of your pain and or your fatigue, which is explained, be that through a functional approach, be that through a structural approach, then actually it's not what you call classic fibromyalgia. There's an entity of a condition, which is fibromyalgia, which is not just there's pain and there's fatigue, but there's a very specific makeup of that, which is also the absence of these other explanations. So I think what I'd like to do is to go a bit deeper into classic fibromyalgia and the makeup of that. Okay. And it would also, I think, be helpful to explore some of these other areas in a bit more detail that you touched on, for example, mitochondrial function, other pieces, mm-hmm. which one with perhaps a less skilled approach might just go, oh, that's fibromyalgia. But actually having some signposts towards some of those pieces that either practitioners that are watching this that can become more aware of looking at those areas, or indeed, as you'll be aware, many patients that have, or people suffering from these conditions have been suffering for many years, often become more expert than many of the physicians that they go and visit simply because of they're living with the suffering of it day to day. So this, what you're calling classic fibromyalgia, for the context of people that are familiar with the Optimal Health Clinic approach, we talk about a maladaptive stress response where effectively the nervous system is in an overstimulated state and that's either perpetuating or causing symptoms. I think, but correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Brady, but I think is that similar to what you're talking about here in terms of how you're, or maybe there are some differences in terms of how you define fibromyalgia.
Yeah, I believe so. It really is. Part of it is a sort of overdriven HPA axis stress response, if you will, but it's deeper than that, it appears. It's not just sort of a sympathetic dominant state. It is, but it's a perpetuated central sensitivity, and we don't exactly know how and why this sort of loop gets locked in these patients' nervous systems. And clearly, there is a susceptibility. We know genetically everyone's about SNPs and genes now, right? So we do know that there's higher predilection of developing something like fibromyalgia in offspring of mothers who had fibromyalgia than not. We know that there's young females that are put in very difficult circumstances in youth, maybe abuse scenarios, feeling patently unsafe, physical trauma, whatever, that don't go on to develop anything like this, and others do. So there's clearly a susceptibility, like there is in most things, right? But there's definitely the best way to, I think, describe it is hypervigilance syndrome. Their nervous system is locked in a situation of hypervigilance, meaning that it's almost like their nervous system is always waiting for the next threat, the next problem to come their way, right? And they need to be on guard and react to it. So it creates a heightened sense of everything. So light touch becomes pain, right? And little things become big things. It's amplification within the deep centers of the brain of everything. And it's likely some level of protective mechanism that these people get into. And in the end, it's not very protective for them, but it's that I think that's probably why it occurs.
Yes.
There's some newer research looking at activation of the microglia in the brain and really deep-seated microinflammatory events and peptides in the brain that might be fueling the fire, if you will, in these deep brain centers. But interestingly enough, fibromyalgia is not systemically inflammatory. Like, these patients don't have elevated SED rates or C-reactive proteins and things like that. So most doctors think it is inflammatory because it's painful. So they've been taught to equate pain with inflammation, but there's a lot of pain that's not driven by inflammation or driven by tissue trauma, you know, which is your classic nociceptive pain. Or they learn a little bit about neuropathic pain in metabolic circumstances like diabetes, but there's a whole third kind of pain that in the pain literature, they actually sometimes refer to as third pain. Some people call it emotional pain. That tends to discount it, right? Make you say that you're just making it up. And that's not the case. This is pain that's very deep-seated, that's poorly understood, but clearly it's an amplification of this aberrant system. And we've been able to pull it apart to a certain degree. Like, these patients with global pain and fatigue syndromes, which, you know, let's say classic fibromyalgia, we know that they have lower brain serotonin and central nervous cerebral spinal fluid serotonin than people who don't have it. When your serotonin levels drop in the cerebral spinal fluid and in the brain, correspondingly, a peptide known as substance P, which is a pain modulating peptide, goes up. They're inversely proportional to one another. When your substance P goes up and it bathes all your association neurons in your spinal cord, it makes these secondary neuron circuits more likely to fire or to turn up. So it's almost like they had the volume turned up on their nervous system. And we use that to our advantage. One of the things that we do is to modulate the serotonergic system. And it's not only the serotonergic system being a little awry in the central nervous system, we see it in the enteric nervous system, which is the nervous system of the gut. And that's why there's this tie-in with IBS, because motility disorders and IBS, serotonin is a major player. So what's cool is, you know, we can kind of kill two birds with one stone, if you will, with going after optimizing serotonergic pathways. But we also have to look at other neurotransmitter patterns that are commonly seen. In hypervigilance disorders, whether it's PTSD or chronic fibro or panic disorder, they tend to overproduce adrenal medullary products known as catecholamine. So epinephrine, norepinephrine, dopamine. And if you look on something like an organic acid test, you see the metabolites of those things elevated quite frequently. And what we do is try to calm the nervous system with nutraceuticals, calming neurotransmitter precursors, CBD, all kinds of different things, and in some case medications, to calm down the catecholamines, upregulate serotonin, lower substance P. And it doesn't always involve biological therapies. Many times it involves cognitive behavioral therapies and heart rate variability and real-time EEG and different kinds of cognitive skills that the patient can learn to sort of change their brain state.
Yes. And I think it's interesting the point that you make as well around even where the origin is within the volume being turned up, let's say, in the central nervous system, that even if the origins of that is some kind of childhood trauma, and be that kind of trauma with a big T, like one big significant event that happened, or be it a kind of more developmental trauma of not being held and nurtured in the way that we needed. Right. So our nervous system didn't learn there's a kind of safe place or a soft place to fall to kind of come back to. That even where the origin may be like that, we're not talking about fibromyalgia, therefore, being all in the mind. We're not talking about it being something that people are making up. It's not any less valid as a lived experience that someone's having. It just so happens that that has an impact on the whole system in terms of how it sets things up for this kind of group of conditions, or specifically classic fibromyalgia in this condition. So it's also interesting as you're talking that in terms of the ways to kind of reset that, that there's coming at that from a psycho-emotional point of view, and I'd actually be curious a bit more of some of the pieces that, that you use there, but also using nutraceuticals, and it sounds like in some instances also pharmaceuticals, to actually help from a kind of biomedical point of view calm down and settle the system. Perhaps, I don't know if there's a way you're able to give any specific kind of case studies or kind of example case studies of how you would kind of combine those different pieces to have a combined effect in terms of actually settling and calming the system.
Yeah, in classic fibromyalgia, as you alluded to, it kind of takes a team, right? And I'm in an integrative medical center here in Connecticut in the USA called Whole Body Medicine. And we, by intention, have built a team of people that have skills across a large array of competencies, because none of us can do it all, right? I'm not a mental health provider, but I've been in practice almost 30 years, and I've seen a lot of patients that have a lot of sort of psychological issues involved in their physical health challenge or condition. So, I can ferret them out. I'm not necessarily the person that's the therapeutic interventional person, but, you know, I have counselors, I have psychologists, and in some cases, psychiatrists that work with us either within our center or we refer out to, that can manage that side of it. And it really depends what the traumas are. Like you mentioned, sometimes it's micro cumulative trauma over many, many years. Sometimes it's one horrific thing. And those have to be dealt with differently. And even in the sort of counseling realm, if you will, I've seen it change and evolve over the years to where earlier in my career, a lot of the techniques used on that side was sort of having to relive it and process it and sort of get beyond it. And that's not really in vogue now. That tends to be...
To re-traumatize someone to try and resolve trauma. Right. It's a kind of odd approach.
Yeah. So now the focus is really on more things like forgiveness therapy. And it's not excusing it therapy if it's abuse, but it's forgiveness personally for yourself to have permission to move on. And sometimes if it's, let's say, abuse by a family member, so maybe a parent, you know, maybe a father figure of a young girl, that's the classic, right? And maybe that person's now elderly and they're changed, they're different. They've come to a different place in their life and there's a way to forge a new relationship, if you will. Sometimes they're deceased and you can't do that, but the person could still reframe it. So I work with people to do that, but then we also have them work with the patients on things that they can control, skills to sort of reset their brain state. Now, many times, one of my colleagues in my practice, Dr. Adam Briner, works a lot with real-time sort of functional EEG studies because he does a lot of traumatic brain injury work, for instance. And we use those types of things to get the patient to sort of almost consciously get in a calmer brain state, in a waking state. But we try to transition them off of office or physician or provider dependent therapies as quick as possible. So we'll get them onto more. Nowadays, we have these app-based cognitive behavioral therapy things on iPods, on iPhones, things like heart rate variability devices that can work really well. We don't want them on there in the evening because we're trying to get them off the electronics at night and get them not in blue light late at night and all that and get them to sleep better and do proper sleep hygiene. But those kind of CBT, cognitive behavioral therapies, are good, you know, and everyone's different. In some patients, it's prayer. In some patients, it's meditation. Some people it's guided imagery or progressive relaxation or non-exertional stretching, hot yoga. I mean, there's a lot of different ways you can go. But that's part of it while we're working on the metabolic sort of biochemical side. And on that side, we're using a lot of things that are calming to the central nervous system and the stress response. So, and I see my colleagues often go wrong in this regard. They'll use adaptogens, right? Because they're good to adapt to stress. Well, your classic adaptogens, things like, let's say, Panax ginseng, or which is Korean or Chinese ginseng, or rhodiola, or licorice, or those are stimulating catecholamine-producing adaptogens that are meant to lift up like shot adrenal glands that are in a really state of low adrenal output. That's not what you need to use in these patients. You'll make them worse. You'll give them worse anxiety, right? We use adaptogens, but we'll use calming adaptogens, things like ashwagandha with if you look at the actual name of ashwagandha, it's withania somnifera, somnolence, right? To promote sleep or a calming state. We'll use things like German chamomile. We'll use precursors to calming neurotransmitters like inositol, L-theanine. We'll use phosphatidylserine, for instance, phosphatidylinositol. But we use nutraceuticals, particularly serotonin precursors like 5-hydroxytryptophan is a big one that we use in our armamentarium. And the literature is really compelling in the use of it in these conditions. We'll use fermented forms of the neurotransmitter GABA, something called pharmaGABA, particularly in a sublingual type of chew. And I don't know what the status of it in the locations where all the listeners may be, but in the US, we've made a lot of strides with having medical marijuana available. But in this case, you don't really even need the medical marijuana because you don't need the THC mind-altering component. You need the cannabinoid component, or there's CBD. So now we've had some clarification in our regulations over here, which has made it a little bit easier and more clear-cut.
It's the same in UK and I think parts of CBD. Europe.
Yeah, so good quality CBD fractions can be very helpful in the anxiety component, in the deep sleep component, and even the pain perceptual component in these classic fibro patients.
That's fascinating. I'm also, one thing actually I wanted to ask of a kind of a gender, particularly how we look at this through our lens of, one of the things that we see is that this kind of activation of the nervous system is, yeah, there's the origins and there's the things that have happened in childhood and those different experiences, but there's also a perpetuating factor of suffering from a condition where no one can tell you what's wrong with it. Appears that no one can tell you what's wrong with you, why is it wrong with you, there's all of these kind of weird symptoms that in of itself becomes its own trauma after a while, and sometimes the underlying trauma is not the piece which is actually causing the ongoing perpetuation of the symptoms.
No doubt.
I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we tend in our acute medicine mind, the way we were all trained in this very myopic Western medicine paradigm, to think that something right now is causing what's right in front of us, right? One bug, one disorder, you know, Koch's postulate, right? And that's the first textbook of medicine. It doesn't work like that in chronic complex disease, right? So, you know, this cumulative trauma or the significant trauma in the past may have been a big part of why this situation manifests itself, but it's actually long gone, right? So there's triggers, there's antecedents, but there's perpetuators, right? So usually there's still stuff going on, right? A lot of people get in another bad relationship as an adult, or they start having this emerge when they have another trauma that comes into their life, right? It kind of reactivates it, if you will, or the straw on the camel's back. So sometimes you have to look into those situations or current social circumstance or relationships and so forth, but that's not always the case. There are many people in very good circumstances, nurturing relationships, you know, not a high stress environment, that are suffering from this. So it takes many, many forms, but you're right. You got to deal with what they have at that moment. But one of the traumas is the whole chronic illness experience, right? Of dealing with providers that don't show compassion, they're discounting. And there was a lot of male-female bias. It's getting less. There's more female providers and things like that. But it's a big issue. And on the other side, you get the chronic illness mentality that sets in the patients themselves often. And it's hard to pull them up out of it. It really, you got to coach them out of it. I remember one time I had a patient come in years ago. I was in a different group, but a group of really good docs, and they came in with a fibromyalgia diagnosis. And what we figured out is they didn't have classic fibromyalgia. They ended up having an undiagnosed, you know, thyroid that was a mess, and they were just metabolically in a very, very bad state. And you know, what we did is we dared to tell the person that we don't think you have fibromyalgia. You have this, and we think you can get better if we treat this. The patient was actually so distraught by learning that they didn't have fibromyalgia. It was, you know, we took their life raft away. Sometimes it takes them so long to get the label that once they have the label, they cling to it because now I have something real. I can tell my family members what I have, right? But you don't want to walk around with that label and never getting treatment because you're afraid to lose the label and get the right treatment, right? So you have to nuance it. But we were, I mean, that one group I was in for a while was actually blacklisted on one of the fibromyalgia support sites. And the reason was given was because we dared to tell a fibromyalgia patient that they can get better.
Optum Health Clinics had a few of those run-ins over the years as well.
Yeah. So, you know, you got to be careful. People with a disorder tend to find others, you know, with the disorder now with the online communities, which is a good thing. The bulk of that is great, right? But you can get in these situations where it's a perpetuating negativity, which is not good.
Yeah, I think the challenge is that when people have been disbelieved or misunderstood for so long, that finally they find people which actually share the worldview that their experience is legitimate, and somehow that then becomes a sense of identity, and it becomes a sense of connection that it's hard to then start to challenge.
It's perfectly understandable from a human perspective. But I've had several of the patients, their actual email address was their disorder.
Yeah. I've seen it on social media as well. It becomes an identity rather than something that's happening to someone, right? You touched on earlier, and if you don't mind, I'd like to just expand a little bit more, that both for someone who's suffering from what they believe might be fibromyalgia, or indeed for practitioners that are working with someone, we've talked quite a bit about what you define as classic fibromyalgia and that piece. But as we touched on towards the start, there's people which can have a whole range of structural things or functional things, and you mentioned briefly some of what that may be. But could we go in a little bit more detail of how, almost not necessarily kind of to 10-step checklist, but almost like what are some of the questions that perhaps you ask yourself as a physician when you're sitting in front of a patient? What are the things that you exclude, and perhaps what's the process through which you go to do that?
Well, here's the reality, right? Things like pain, things like fatigue, these are common symptoms that a lot of people have for a lot of different reasons.
Yes.
Therefore, it would not be uncommon at all for people to have both pain and fatigue for reasons that have nothing to do with fibromyalgia, but they're existing concomitantly. But like you said, it's a ticket to get that diagnosis, right? So you have to weed through all of this and try to find out. And there are a lot of things that can cause this, but I can tell you what I feel are the three, and I talk about this in my book, because in my book, The FibroFix, I try to take, the book was written for patients, right? I've written a million medical journal articles and textbook chapters and all that for my colleagues, but people for years were telling me, you need to write a book for the patients. And I kind of always, for various reasons, didn't do it. I finally did do it. And it's The FibroFix, and it's really meant to not make you a doctor, but it's meant to make you a very informed advocate for yourself through this, to navigate this healthcare system that doesn't do a good job with patients like you, right? So now a lot of healthcare providers read it and they learn a lot from it and they love it and they recommend it to patients so that the patient can better understand the kind of things they're doing and investigating. But the book talks about, what is this classic fibromyalgia? What's the origins of it? What do we understand about it? And more, maybe as important or statistically more importantly, what's not fibromyalgia? And what are the other most common things that get diagnosed or labeled as fibromyalgia? And we put these in what we call buckets, different categories, if you will. And we work the reader through a lot of different questionnaires and different examinations of their own experience and their symptoms and so forth, and try to have them figure out, does it really sound like I have this classic fibromyalgia thing, or does it more sound like I have one of the other things that is getting me the diagnosis, and if so, which one? And then we give ideas on how you go about trying to maybe address whatever that is, whatever bucket you're in, and how to find the right kind of provider to help you through all of this, right? To try to find a good functional integrative like healthcare provider that may have a clue, particularly when you get into some of the more functional things that usually fly below the radar of the very conventionally trained doctor. Like one of the masqueraders is poor performing or suboptimal ATP energy production, so mitochondrial function. So if you have mild to moderately uncoupled mitochondrial respiration, you will not make a lot of energy or ATP, therefore you will be fatigued, You'll have brain fog, so-called fibro fog, because your brain needs a lot of ATP. And you will end up with muscle pain, because if you're not making energy well through aerobic mitochondrial respiration, you'll back up into anaerobic metabolism to some degree on a chronic basis. So you're producing lactic acid and other types of metabolites that cause pain in the muscles, particularly if a doctor comes and mashes his finger there to challenge you to see if you have pain, right? So sometimes it's as easy as trying to find out, is there energy deficiency at a cellular basis, and addressing that. And for that, it really takes an integrative functional physician most of the time, because you got to turn to things like organic acid tests and other types of functional testing. So one of the main masqueraders is mitochondrial issues. The second masquerader is hypothyroidism, which is extremely common in women as they get older, right? It's mostly women, very less likely men, right? And it takes many forms. If it's really overt, classic, in-your-face primary hypothyroidism, your general physician usually finds it, right? Your TSH is through the roof and your hormone, you know, your T4 is low. But there's a lot of more subtleties to thyroid function than most of the providers look for. So we look at, not only are you making enough total T4, but are you converting it in the periphery, which is an enzymatically dependent reaction, which a lot of stuff has to go right, right? So genomically, if you're not making enough of the enzyme, or you're making a warped enzyme, or you don't have the right nutritional cofactors, and these are called the deiodinase enzymes, the 5' and 5-deiodinase enzymes, we measure their functionality. We look for T3 resistance syndrome. We look for all kinds of different subtleties of thyroid function that you have to get right, or the patient often feels like they got hit by a bus. And that includes muscle ache, it includes fatigue, it includes brain fog, it includes slow bowels, so you get constipation, and you get IBS type of symptoms. So thyroid is number two. And the third biggest masquerader is structural muscular issues, right? Myofascial pain syndrome, trigger points, postural distortion patterns, disc hernia, you know, disc injuries, facet syndromes, all of that kind of stuff that you really do need a really good physical medicine body worker type of provider usually to address. The problem is that a lot of those providers treat a lot of patients who say they have fibromyalgia. They do what they do with their physical medicine. Many of the patients get better. So the perception of the provider is, when I do this, I'm curing fibromyalgia. Right. No, you're treating successfully probably myofascial pain syndrome. Because you mislabeled it and got something better doesn't mean you cured the disorder that you inappropriately labeled it as, right? If that's not fair in medicine. If that was the case, then every patient I see is going to have an astrocytoma of the brain or pancreatic cancer, because I'm going to start getting a lot of people better with those two disorders, right? And I'm being facetious, obviously, but it's like in the States here, you know, it's a little different than the environment in the UK. I mean, you go on the internet and look at a lot of physical medicine providers, you know, physios and chiropractors and things like that, and usually on most of their practice ads, it'll list fibromyalgia, right? Very few of them are treating fibromyalgia like we're talking about, centrally mediated disorder and attacking it centrally. They're doing physical medicine for physical problems that are being misappropriated as fibromyalgia. And that's not me saying that. The medical literature, large study by Fitzpatrick, one of the preeminent researchers in fibromyalgia, rheumatologist, took large numbers of fibromyalgia patients who were diagnosed as fibromyalgia and referred to rheumatology, right? These were diagnosed by family physicians, internists, and rheumatologists. They were then examined by an expert panel of rheumatologists highly trained in fibromyalgia, and they corroborated the diagnosis that generated the referral of fibromyalgia only about 34% of the time, which means 66% of the time it was incorrect.
Yes.
Which means the doctors would have done a lot better to flip a coin.
And also, as you said right at the start, that having the right diagnosis is an enormously important part of the process, because if you think you've got a diagnosis of one thing and actually it's something else, you can literally spend decades going down the wrong path and being frustrated. And of course, one of the things that often happens with this group of patients is they become impaired in their ability to work. They're spending large amounts of money, often trying different treatments. And I think after decades of that, people understandably become very disillusioned and become somewhat feeling hopeless in terms of the potential of anything being able to help them. As we come towards the end, perhaps as a second to last question, one of the things I'd be curious to hear is when you have those patients come and see you, where you can see that they've been systematically failed by the medical profession, and perhaps they've only really made it through your door because they've come across someone else who's seen you, who's been significantly helped, and they're like, I'm just going to try this one last thing. What do you say to those kinds of patients to help re-engage them with the potential for things to change?
Well, I guess the first thing is I acknowledge their right to be frustrated, and I acknowledge the failings in the system. And I've apologized on behalf of my colleagues for some of the ways that I've heard through their stories that they've been treated and dismissed. So I think that helps, you know, reset sort of the relationship and the patient-doctor encounter. And I make it very clear to them that, you know, I'm not some magic healer. I can't guarantee I'm going to get you better. All I can guarantee is I'm going to give you my best effort to try to get to the bottom of why you feel the way you do. And I'm not going to do it based on an agenda. I'm not going to put you on a certain therapy like some providers do, because that's the therapy they do. So, you know, they have a hammer and everyone's a nail. I try to come into it without an agenda. And I tell them, I'm going to go where your story brings me. And I'm going to go, maybe even more importantly, where the data brings me. So I'm going to test, and I'm going to use the best tools I have. And hey, 20 years down the road, we're going to have a lot better tools. I'm going to look back at what I'm doing now and probably be embarrassed, but it's the best we have right now. But I'm going to look into it, and I'm going to go where the story and the data leads me. But we're going to have to try some things, because in the end, it's a personal experience, right? You have to do an intervention based on clinical experience, on the data, on doing the most appropriate thing given the circumstances. But the, you know, where the rubber meets the road is their outcome. So I'm going to work with them on their journey. I'm more their health coach. I'm someone who's their advocate along with them, and we're trying to get to the bottom of it. And if I can't, then I'm going to try to do my best to get them to someone else who I think may have an answer. We're not going to stop.
Dr. Brady, it's been fascinating. I really appreciate not only the depth of your knowledge, but also your passion for this group of patients. You mentioned your book, FibroFix. That's obviously one place people can find out more about you and your work. Say a bit more about how people can find out both about your practice and anything else you'd like to share in terms of people that want to connect with you or go deeper into your work.
Sure. If someone's particularly interested in fibromyalgia, global pain, fatigue syndromes, and so forth, if you think you have it, you have a family member who might have it, you're a provider, want to learn more about it, resources for your patients, probably the best place to visit is fibrofix.com, FIBROFIX.com. And there's a lot of resources there, lots of interviews, lots of journal articles, lots of articles for the general public, TV appearances. There's the intro and first chapter to the book that you can read just as a complimentary thing. There's some white papers. There's all kinds of different resources, information on different types of interventional strategies I use. Also, if you're on Facebook, just Dr. David Brady, Facebook.com/Dr. David Brady. If you have more interested in some of the other work that I do in functional gastroenterology, work in the microbiome and some of the novel molecular diagnostic testing I've helped develop in that regard, and autoimmune work that I've done, you can probably just visit my main site, which is just drdavidbrady.com, drdavidbrady.com. Once again, it's chock full of different resources that I try to share as freely as possible. I have a lot of full text to many of my papers and so forth. So those are probably the best two sources. And I guess I'll leave it at that.
Fantastic. Dr. Brady, thank you so much for your time and your it's been a pleasure. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
I appreciate it. Okay. Bye-bye.